This podcast includes strong language, descriptions of war, and deals with issues of trauma and death.
Hello, this is More Tea. For those who are looking for a little bit more of our Tea and Medals podcast, I'm Jess Bracey, one of the producers on the show, and I am here with Darren, our host, and we're talking about some of the stories that complement our main episodes.
Hello, Jess. So, what are we talking about this week?
So, as we all know, season two has launched with a great episode last week. Why don't we start from there?
Yeah, well, in our last episode, we met WO2 John Thompson, who until recently was the most highly decorated Royal Marine Commando.
And that is such an amazing episode. How did you actually get to be the most highly decorated Royal Marine?
Well, as you know, the awards for bravery that the UK gives out are very rare. The highest award is the Victoria Cross, and there aren't really many people alive who hold that award. The second highest award, which is equal in stature, really, to the Victoria Cross, is the George Cross, and that's for actions not in the face of the enemy. So the next highest award in the face of the enemy is the Conspicuous Gallantry Cross, and that award was only commissioned in the 1990s, which means it's actually really rare. Hardly anybody's got it.
And Tomo was awarded a CGC for his actions during Operation Herrick in Afghanistan. But as some of the listeners will know, Tomo has many stories. And what set him apart as the most highly decorated serving Royal Marine was that he was also mentioned in dispatches.
Yeah, so we heard all about Tomo's time in Iraq during our chat. We decided to cut that just for time, really. But that doesn't mean that it's not a story worth listening to.
Yes, let's hear more from Tomo.
It was a slow start where I learnt how to be a commando. I did a deployment to Northern Ireland, like I said. So I got a gong. Oh, my first gong, Northern Ireland. And I thought that was going to be the only one, and then it wasn't. And then Kosovo kicked off, and the Congo was a thing. I never didn't go to those, but I then deployed to Telek 1 with Delta Company 40 Commando.
So you're on Ark Royal for that?
HMS Ark Royal, yeah, which was fantastic. I'd been on Ocean and I'd been on Galahad and some other ships, but there's nothing so much. It's very comfortable living on an aircraft carrier. And you then became the weapon system for the ship's captain. And it's a different type of shipping in comparison to the troop carrier ones, and a different type of matlo as well. So it was a real team environment there. It was great.
The Gulf War is going on now. Troops are massing on the border, mm-hmm. And you're off the coast. Tell us about your foray into the Gulf War then.
This is war. This is really it. So I'd say watch Saving Private Ryan in training and thought, oh my God. And I think everyone has some slight imposter syndrome of the unknown beyond the step at which they're about to take and how they're going to react. You know, it could be the first time you kiss a girl. Oh, am I going to mess it up? First time you kick a drop kick at the end of the game and then you fluff it up and everyone's like, boo you. So I was always really concerned of how I was going to react in war because you've never ever been in that situation. It's a really niche position to be in. And I'm in my mess deck with the rest of Delta Company and my fire support group, or it was called a combat team then. And I was watching Patriot missiles hit Baghdad and thinking, this is it, this is it. And everybody really wants to go more than anything else, but it still has trepidations about what does that actually mean. All the battle prep's done, you've been doing loads of fears, you've been customising vehicles, the kit's laid out, ammunition's been drawn, and you're just waiting.
And this is what I would, and everyone, I guess, would describe as proper war. This is
full-scale land invasion of a country.
Conventional war. There's no. It is literally tanks on the border, troops ready to go, yeah. Aircraft in the air above you.
Yeah.
For the Marines, maritime landing. Mm-hmm. Proper war. This is what everyone's trained for.
Yeah. The only time that this can be compared to is World War II. So we had the Falklands with the Paras and Guards and other excellent services. But it wasn't multinational either. This was big war against a big enemy. You know, Iraq had the fourth largest land army on the planet.
And were experienced as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the Iraq long time.
Yeah, yeah. And the weapon systems like ZSU-23-4, which is an anti-aircraft weapon system of 4 23mm guns, which is the same as double the size of a 50 cal, but four of them, that each of them can fire 1,000 rounds a minute. and the Russians were using them in the ground role to in urban warfare. That thing would just tear through anything with uranium tipped rounds. Mm. And they had thousands of them, and T-72s and T-80s. And as an anti-tank specialist, I knew what the armour could do. And desert warfare is not an infantry theatre. It is a fast-moving, mobile, armoured adventure. And it's devastating. I mean, I had the chance to be a warrior commander once on Salisbury Plain. That is hard. It's really, really fast paced. So everything's laid out and we're ready to go. It's full-scale land invasion of another country. Big bombs are being dropped. B-2 bombers dropping 1,000 and 2,000-pound JDAMs. You've got AC-130s masking the air and covering for the Chinooks from the RAF. You've got Sea Kings going in. Battery Commander and BRF, HQ Hilo got shot down. And we're hearing all this in the tank deck of HMS Ark Royal with just the red lights in that tank deck. And then suddenly...
it's your turn.
It goes green. You pick up your stuff. It's heavy as fuck. You're sweating. You've put cam cream on, but really there's no point having cam cream on in the desert. That's dripping into your eyes. You're aware of everybody else in the tank deck, the Matlows around you and of how you look. So you've got to stand tall, carrying 50 cal machine guns and things.
I take it you were an NTO by then as well.
I was, yeah. So I'd done my junior command course and my twos. So I was, I was a non-commissioned corporal.
Yeah.
With a team of eight guys in two vehicles and two 50 cal machine guns. And as part of a wider combat group of Delta Company of 40 Commando of the coalition forces for the invasion. And you get on the ramp, like in Navy SEALs, because the only context you've got is movies, but it's not like the movies. And then the ramp comes down. You can hear the sound of the helos whirring above. You can feel the coolness of the outside air sort of emanate in. So it's like a slight breeze pecking on your face. You get on the ramp with immense pride that you're the ones going in. And you can almost imagine what the other people are doing, looking at you going in. And you feel big, but you're also a little bit nervous as well.
And you're carrying hundreds of kilos of kit.
Absolutely. And then you go up. It's dark. It's loud. You can smell the exhaust fumes coming out of the Chinooks. And, you know, you would have been on Chinooks. You're there. It's uncomfortable. Your life jacket's bringing your head down. Your neck aches. And then you're waiting just for those two silos to bring you to the back of the Chinook, and the engines are roaring, it's burning your face, and then you get in, quickly sit down, kit on, point your weapon down, obviously. Then you just start looking at each other. Because the helo's already gone down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you'd heard that.
Yeah.
As in, it'd already been passed around.
Yeah.
So I guess my next question is, there's probably three words that you train that you use a lot through all your training. Every part of training is contact, wait out.
Yeah.
I guess you train all the time. Contact, wait out.
Yeah, yeah.
Bang, bang, bang. What's it like when you hear those words for real, probably for the first time? Because Northern Ireland would have been a completely different kind of
tool. Northern Ireland was nothing, really. It's out of all finished. But, I mean, we're all on nets, and that's one of the greatest things about being a commander is you're on the net. And you hear everything that's going around. And you become the conduit for awful information to everybody else because there's only so many radios to go around.
Yeah.
So I love having a radio. And then you hear contact wait out. Iraq, there was a few contacts going up to the time that I was had done something that was worthy of a mention in dispatches. And then things change.
So for those that don't know, contact wait out means that somebody's being shot at and everyone else should now clear the net to give them an opportunity to...
It's a wonderful thing, as far as I'm concerned. And what it does is it shows the real importance of the commander, no matter the lowest level of the commander or whoever's got that radio, everybody else shuts up.
Mm.
They wait for that. The direction, it could be the OC's or the colonel's direction of where you want to go. Contact happens here. That's the most important person in the ground. Everyone stops and is going to direct their attention to that and just waits. They can do some preparatory stuff and get ready, but it's what's happening there because we don't have eyes on. We didn't have drones then. We didn't have Reaver cameras like you would do in later wars. And we didn't have little...
So you're pretty old school. You're waiting for direction to support the person.
And they're your friends as well. Yeah. So they're my mates. They're people I live with. There's people I've drunk with. There's people I've had arguments with. There's people that I've lost dice to and I've had to make them food. They're just the most wonderful people in the world that you would do anything for. And they're in contact.
And you want to go.
Yeah, absolutely. Because there's a big army out there somewhere. Mm. Where are they?
So tell us about what happens then. I think it was Combat Team 1.
That was Combat Team 1 that got contacted.
They got contacted and you were Combat Team 3.
I was in Combat Team 3, right at the back, really threaders. So Combat Team, we were doing, Alpha Company, 40 Commander, were doing a clearance of the Alphor town. Having moved on the Alphor Peninsula, we'd cleared the petroleum pipelines, which had secured that area from sabotage and destruction from the Fedayeen forces of the Ba'ath Party, which meant the Iraqis could have oil and supplies. And then we pushed further north. A few flittering contacts on the way up until we got to a main arterial route from the east to the west, which led to Basra, which effectively was called the Basra Road. Big industrial area, kind of like in, what's it called, Full Metal Jacket. And in front of us is a big science college. And then Alphor town was off to the east and north. We went fast on the road, 50 cows, Milan, GPM GSF in four vehicles. All those 50 cows were strapped down onto wooden pallets with ratchet straps, and you'd have one gun facing front and one gun facing rear and one gun facing left and one gun facing right. So you could get all, as you were moving, you would have cover and fire in 6,400 mils or 4,600 mils, whatever it is. I haven't done that kind of stuff for ages. The Combat Team 1 went out to the west and to the north to cover the top of Alpha Town. Combat Team 2 went in direct support of Alpha Company. We were just waiting there. Nothing was happening for us. It's really hot. Just like, oh my God, these guys have got to move and something's going to happen for them. You know, I'm excited, but contact wait out comes over the net from Combat Team 1. Bang. I go from snooze effectively into 100% alert. And just listening on that, and I'm telling everybody else around me, Combat Team 1's in contact. Everyone's packing up anything out they've got out away and just waiting for the command to move on the net. And then the command came. They'd been ambushed and they were stuck. Didn't know much more than that at the time. And Combat Team 3 were tasked to move in, echeloning through Combat Team 2 and Alpha Company to go and extract them from the location. So we turned right, went east on the Basra Road down to a checkpoint held by Alpha Company and waited and waited and waited. In Iraq, they dropped power lines and put wire across the road to try and take your head off as you're driving past. So on the front of our vehicles, we'd have 6-foot pickets engineered so they would have a hook. So if we went through some wire, it would cut them. Waiting at that checkpoint, you know, looking left and right, civilians, and you see that Middle Eastern girl with the striking green eyes and, you know, sticks in like the same in National Geographic. Boom. This is about to kick off and everybody else, you can feel the tension around the civilian population. So we're just waiting to go, go, go. And mine was a lead wagon with three others behind me. And then it was go. It was just as we were starting to use GPSs. So we had these big maps, one in 100,000. So tiny, tiny squares.
And a massive GPS.
Yeah. Well, we had ship's compasses. Right. On the front of our vehicles in a completely stripped down Pinsgau. So there's zero armour. Your ECBA's just got that one plate. It's not like it is now. And then you go and it's just drive, 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 drive. You can be contacted and ambushed at any time, but you've got to get to where the fight is. And you can hear the echoes of RPGs or bombs or whatever it is, but you don't know until you've seen it exploding. And all you know is that your friends, 30 other guys, are stuck in an ambush, potentially, and they may be dead, or some of them may be dead, or may be injured.
It must be a situation that you encountered a lot afterwards. You hear that distant machine gun fire, distant RPG explosions, distant IEDs going off throughout your career, and it just must put your senses like, boom, right, here we go, ready for this.
Absolutely. I get very... very excited about like a mortar bomb coming in. I love it because I know what's going to happen. The complexity of your world suddenly reduces down to a really, really fine laser-like focal point. All the bullshit that you've been thinking about dissipates and you know what's going to happen. And the only thing that I think about in those situations is I will do everything that I possibly can to make sure everybody that's around me lives and anybody who's trying to do anything bad doesn't, or is halted from doing that. It's really, really simple.
You've written about, and you've talked in the past about the here and now, mm-hmm. and I guess that's the description of it. It's about nothing else matters. What's happening now is all that is important.
You should never live in the past. The past, I mean, I don't even remember half the things that I've done in my military career, because they now become insignificant. As soon as you take another breath, unless you know that's going to lead on to something else, it's insignificant. It doesn't do you any help. And most of us carry around these giant bags of guilt and shame that affect how we react in any situation. And it's so detrimental. You've got to get rid of that. As long as you know you're a good person who lives with integrity and honesty, care and compassion, then you've got nothing to worry about for letting go in the past. And then if you step into the future all the time, it's made up. That's not going to do you any help. That's like living on the internet. What about here and now? You end up losing everybody that you love. So we start to hammer down the road. And in the distance, probably about 600 metres away, I can see just explosions from left and right of the road. The whole topography of the ground is flat, with a wide road, probably about two or three lanes wide, with sort of dirty white, off-white sort of flat roof buildings. And then on the left-hand side of that is huge fig date plantations, which are crisscrossed with massive irrigation ditches, really, really deep. And then out to the east is the Shatt al-Arab River, which is the natural border between Iraq and Iran. And as we were driving down towards this contact area, we were getting fleeting fire from Iranian border forces. Came up to about 400 metres and we stopped short, just a little a T-junction. We moved into a Zulu muster, which is a holding point for vehicles. The drivers had to stay with the vehicles. That was the TTPs that we used. So our standard operating procedures was the drivers always had to stay with the vehicles. And they were pissed off with that because it was going ballistic down the road. So about 400 metres. From that position, we were in cover on the side of the road. It was myself and six guys, because the driver stayed with the vehicles. And you could see one's Pinzgauer closer, which was about 400 metres, and then probably about 20 metres in front of that on the right-hand side, were just exploding. There's RPGs fire going everywhere, direction of which I don't know, and then you can just hear machine gun fire, and you can't see anybody. It's basically just a big cloud of smoke and chaos down the road. All we know is we've got to get up to there to find Combat Team 1 and see where they are. Can't hear anything on the net. So we decide to get into some cover, and the best cover is a fig date plantation, so which means we've got to get straight across the road. Machine gun fires intermittently pepper potting down the road and get into the fig date plantations, which is a whole world in itself. So you've gone from semi-urbanized area with clear open firing lanes, and you can move quickly because it's hard ground, and you've got great observation into not dense, but very dark woodland-like area, which is far more humid than the red hot road, but still very hot. And then the canals, which are deep. They're wide and they're deep. And every man is carrying just a ton of ammunition. You know, a GPMG gun is carrying 1,600 rounds, which is heavy. And we've got grenades, and we've all got 10 magazines, we've all got bandoliers, we've got rocket grenade, RGGS, which goes on the end of your rifle to shoot rockets. We've got eyelaws. And as soon as you get into that, well, so if you had that, you'd then just fall out. If you tripped and fell over, that's it, you're gone. Another guy would have to take all his kit off whilst you were sinking down into there, drowning, to try and get you out. And he probably still wouldn't even be able to pull you out. So we're really acutely aware of that. And I'd just come off my command course, my junior command course. In a patrol, you're supposed to have a lead scout who covers the front arcs, and then the commander who can nav and maintain the communications. And then it continues all the way back to the tail end Charlie, and you split different weapons up. And I picked a guy, I'm not going to say his name, but I picked a guy, and I was like, right, you're going to be lead scout. And he's like, fucking no, I'm not. And I was like, which makes me laugh still today. And so I was like, okay, I'll go first. I'll have to take the responsibility. So we made our way, trying to understand where we were without getting lost, to follow the road towards the contact area. Because as soon as we got into the fig date plantation, the sound of the battle became muffled. And with the heat and the sweat and the natural anxiety, it's simple, it's easy and understandable that you could become disorientated. Moving through the buildings that then projected further back, which would stop movement because of the water courses, we have to jump through windows, which is chest height, with all of that weight. It's not a deliberate action. The first window we came to, I had to throw a grenade, the first live grenade. I've never successfully thrown a grenade in my life. I'm really good at machine guns, but grenades not so much. So I pulled the pin on a grenade. Right, here we go, throw the grenade. And I threw it, ideally, to get inside the building and explode, knowing that I don't know who's in there. There could be anybody in there, but our need of safety is greater than the potential repercussions from there. And it bounced off the lintel and it came back to in front of us and exploded. Nobody was hurt. We all laughed. And we're like, yeah, good. And then got through. And then movement became quicker. I remember stumbling across a family of Iraqis, which was men and lots of women and lots of children, who were just absolutely petrified of this sheer chaos of what's going on around them. You know, and they're stuck fast in a petrified stillness about themselves losing their lives and their livelihoods and what's going to happen. And then they see us, you know, me, 6'2", armour, weapon.
Sweating,
having just thrown a grenade at myself. I come up to them and the women are just shaking. And you've never seen fear like it before. It's overwhelming what's happened to them. The children are scared, and the women, you can see from beneath their burqas that they're wetting themselves whilst you stood there. And you do the thing, you take your sunglasses off and you try and display some level of calmness, or that you're not there to hurt them, because you're really not, but you are an invader to their country, and they've never even met somebody like you before, and they've just been told what they've told, but you're definitely not there to hurt anyone. It's an exceptional force for good. But all you can do is direct them to safety, and then off they run. And we've still got to get to where we've got to go. We've got a mission, you know, and they are important, but they're secondary in my mind to the mission of getting our guys out, or at least finding them, because they could be laid dead or dying or need medical help. And you continue forward. Realise that sticking in these buildings is a pain in the ass. Can't see anything. The only thing you've got is your silver compass, which is getting thrown out by your weapon and everybody else's weapon around you. So you're hopefully going in a general direction. We had a general bearing, and we had to get back out onto the road. I remember coming out of the building onto the road, and we're getting closer. It's probably about 200 metres to the killing area now. We moved forward and came to another junction, and I moved forward to the wall, looked west to see if it was clear so that I could be the cover man so that the guys could get across the obstacle, which is the gap in the road, and saw a number of people up the road, probably about 70 metres away. I got engaged by RPG fire, which exploded right where I was. Engulfed, I mean, I was told this later on by one of my friends, Canada, exploded all around me, blew me off my feet, made my ears ring, and I was covered in dust. And I remember hearing the rest of my section say, "Oh no, Tomo's dead." And I was like, "I'm not dead." And I got up and I was like, "Oh, my ears are ringing a bit." And I had to shout, "I'm okay, I'm okay." And it was like, yeah, fantastic. Managed to get across the obstacle and continue in the direction of where the killing area was. Intensity of the fire is increasing. Definitely two pins gowers destroyed. You can hear the air bottles from the Milan, which were used to cool down the Myra thermal site, exploding. This compressed air of steel grenades, effectively, just going up in flames, which have now become, you know, our piece of kit, which was friendly to us, has now become a weapon that fate can use against us. So the world becomes a little bit more dangerous. We stumble to the next building and come across members of Combat Team 1, which is Hoofing, you know, some good friends that I lived with, and they tell us what's happened. They've been ambushed from all sides. They've taken out the first, you know, textbook, taken out the first vehicle, didn't take out the last vehicle, unfortunately for the enemy, and took out a second vehicle. And it was such a ferocious initiation of an ambush that there was nothing that our guys could do apart from evacuate from their vehicles, leaving in some cases weapons, so primary weapon systems, sometimes their own personal weapon systems. All the kits destroyed, sighting systems, everything. They just had to get out. You know, Pinzgau is literally made of fiberglass or the thinnest metal possible, and it's just exploding next to you with an absolute overwhelming rate of machine gun fire. So they bombursted left and right. Some guys had gone down to the Chatelarab and got missing, and other guys had come into the buildings. We'd met about a section's worth of guys. Everyone's like high-fiving, woo, brilliant. But they needed to know where to go. We needed to move forward to see if we can find some more people. So we directed them to where our Zulu muster was. I didn't know then, but the rest of the company had moved up into the Zulu muster with TAC and MAIN in the area. So Sergeant Major and the OC's groupings. And we continue to move forward. So we'd seen this for one part of the combat team. Vehicles are under effective enemy fire still, and they're trying to blow up the rest of the vehicles. There's 7.62 from PKMs, there's and 7.62 from AK-47s, and there's RPGs flying around everywhere. There's potentially 82mm mortars going off in the air, but the cacophony of the battle is just too loud. Need to get a higher vantage point, need to positively identify our guys. So myself and my boss, at the time, we moved up onto a building to get a greater eyes on the ambush site, see if we can see anyone. Noticed three Fedayeen guys running down an alleyway, neutralised them, dead before they hit the ground. So that's the first time I'd ever killed anyone, and first time that my boss had ever killed anyone, and we were both pretty happy with that. That's certainly one of the hurdles that you have to travel through to become an effective combatant. And then we moved down because we had proper eyes on the location. Moved a little bit further forward, and I decided that we needed to get the vehicles that had not been destroyed out of that killing area. So I dropped off a point of fire and asked for covering fire and ran out into the killing area. Bullets ricocheting all off the floors, obviously, as the enemies found this new target and get into a Pinzgauer. And if you've ever driven a Pinzgauer, they're a pain in the ass. Mm. You get in, you've got this crappy key. Turn the key to try and start the engine, all the while machine gun fire is ripping off the dashboard. You've got to get in the first gear, which is like in the wrong place, and then you've got to lift up and twist the handle down, and it's got a crappy turning circle, and I'm in that wagon with revs just going really high, and I've got to get it out there. Managed to turn the vehicle around with air bursts going off and zoom off down the road with my section on the right hand side as I'm passing them. That's what I noticed. TAC and MAIN are in the Zulu muster. And I hammered down the 400 metres back to them and screeched to a halt with this vehicle, get out and quickly have a face-to-face with my Sergeant Major, tell him what's going on. The rest of the combat team one had got there. I run back down the road. It's Redders. I'm hanging out. My knees are hurting. My back's hurting. I've just killed somebody. But there's another Pinzgauer that needs to be rescued. We've landed in Iraq. We've only got so much kit. This is mission essential. The war isn't stopping. We've got to continue moving on. So we've got to do our part for the wider mission. And I run down, and all I'm thinking of as I'm going down is, right, I've got to start this vehicle first time because it's still chaos in this killing area. We've been surrounded by 270 degrees. So all three sides in front of our direction travel. And I run into the next vehicle, start it up, first gear, revs high, clutch down, handbrake off, and I fucking stall it. Jesus, I stall it. No, machine guns fires going everywhere. Manage to start it again, boof, fires up, turn around, off I go. And I'm literally starting to panic now because I've just stalled it. And I'm willing this vehicle to go faster and faster, like leaning my head forward, just like a sprinter in a 100-meter race to try to get across that line. And then zoom, straight back up to the company. Screech to a halt. I'm sure somebody spoke to me, but I knew I had to get go back to my section and make sure they were okay. So whether I was told to stay there or whatever, I don't know. I just continued down the road. I remember, I think they're called Anglicos, which are American TAC-P. So fast air controllers who was attached to us because of the lack of TAC-P air controllers on the ground. And I ran past him and I looked him in the eyes as I ran past, and he's like, hey man, if we were with our guys, we'd be dead by now. I was like, woo! I was fucked as well. I was like, gave him a high five as I ran back down the road for the 400 meter slog back to my section, but they're still there and they don't know anything.
This all didn't happen in a flash. This is like 6 hours in total.
6 hours. It's the hardest day of my life.
Yeah. So, I mean, the way you describe it, it's like 5 minutes of hard work and then high fives of the Americans. But this is like running around, heat, sweat, kit, getting shot at. 6 hours.
You're literally, your body's on fire. You know, your body's just like adrenaline, keep your knees working because you're carrying so much kit and it's redders and you can only carry so much water. Yeah. So what you think is running isn't running. It's like you're going as fast as you can.
Shuffle.
But the key is, and this is a commando spirit, and a spirit that's in every battalion, is you don't give up. You got a higher purpose and it's not you. And that's where you get the greatest sense of achievement. Because that higher purpose wasn't really those vehicles, but it was what those vehicles allowed you to do afterwards. The higher purpose was going back and getting a section and making sure everybody came out alive. That's a higher purpose. That's a human connection. And that's a whole business of the bonds that keeps us together. That will transcend anything. Chaos cannot defeat that.
Wow. Another amazing story. And Tomo really knows how to tell it in a way that people who might not have experienced it can still appreciate it.
Yeah, I really need to thank Tomo. And not to forget his mate Ads, who is Sergeant Ads Lyson. For their time, and wish them both really all the best because they've both left the armed forces now. So, what's next?
Well, the next episode is going to be a bit different as we are off to Malta to delve into why the island was awarded a George Cross during the first half of the Second World War. So really looking forward to sharing that with you. Don't forget that you can watch the full episodes on the BFBS Creative YouTube. And if you're listening, please leave us a few comments on what other stories you would like to hear.
That's all for now. If you like the series, rate it, leave us a review, and share it with your mates.